Welcome to the Nonfiction Podcast. I'm Matt Buzzatieri. First, let me just say welcome back to the show after a four-week summer hiatus. It's really exciting to be back. We've got a great episode. But before we get started, just a quick request. If you're enjoying this show, please do me a favor and rate the show on iTunes or even write a review. You probably hear this on every podcast, and it's for a good reason. The more people that review and write about your show, the more chances are that other people are going to discover it. So if you can, please do me a favor and rate the show. I'm really excited to be back this week, also because this episode I'm talking with Danielle Bacher about her story for Esquire magazine, My Autistic Brother's Quest for Love. This was a fantastic story that I read months ago, and I finally had the chance to catch up with Danielle to talk about it. She's written for Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vanity Fair, GQ, Maxim, Men's Journal, Billboard, and LA Weekly. Here's a brief excerpt from that story. I am woken by a loud commotion. It's 1996 and I'm 10 years old, 2 years older than my brother Randy. He's banging on the wall our room share, boom, 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 and screaming, I'm so stupid, I want to die. Our mother, Farron, runs into his room and I follow close behind. Amber hair matted against her damp forehead, she moves towards him. Seated in the worn wooden chair by his desk and cups her clammy hands around his pale face, she holds him close. He tries to smash his fist against the wall, then his head, but she catches him just in time. I stand in the doorway in my pajamas. He looks over at me, his eyes red and awash in sadness. Why can't I be normal like you, Dan? He asks. He buries his hands in his lap and screams, It's not fair. I hate myself. My mother cries with him. I love you with all my heart, she says, holding him tightly around his waist, trying her best to calm him. Please never forget that. I love you. My brother has always wanted what most of us do, love. Someone to care about. Someone who will care in return. Someone other than our mother. If you haven't already read this story, I recommend you do and pause the show, come back when you've finished. Otherwise, fair warning as always, we'll be talking about everything about the story, so some details may be spoiled. And with that, with no further delay, here is my interview with Danielle Bacher. I'm talking with Danielle Bacher. She's the writer of My Autistic Brother's Quest for Love, which appeared in Esquire magazine this February. Danielle, thanks for coming on the show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this story. I read this a few months ago, and I was really moved by it and impressed by this story. It's very different than a lot of the stories that I've talked to authors about so far on the podcast, and that it's very personal. It's about your brother and some of his challenges. And so I was kind of curious, first of all, what made you decide to share this and write about this?
Well, I had always wanted to write something personal. It's not something I often do, but I just had, you know, grown up with my brother, Randy, who's autistic, and I've always wanted to kind of share, you know, a story about it because I think it's interesting and I want people to learn more about it. And I had flown to New York. I live in Los Angeles to meet with a bunch of editors, and I met with one at Esquire, and we were just talking about ideas for stories that I could do, and he's just like, you know, we're looking for something new and different, and I was just like, well, I'd love to write a story about my brother. He's autistic and has special needs, and he's like, all right, let's talk about that. Like, what story do you want to write? And I don't know, it just came to me, like, why don't I write about his love life? Like, I haven't read many pieces about that. I think it's interesting because he's at an age where often you don't write about that, like, mid-20s, late-20s. It's just not something, you know, usually you read about autism and you read about young children. So I just thought it was an interesting age to kind of reflect on this love and how hard it is, because it's definitely not easy. So that's how it came to be.
And how did you broach the subject with him? Obviously, he's involved in the story and he was obviously aware of the story. You know, how did you approach him to talk about the fact that you were going to write about him and some very personal things about his life?
Yeah, I first broached it with my family, with my mom and dad. My dad was in like full support of me writing the article. My mother, not as much. So, you know, she was basically like, why do you have to write about our family and Randy? Like, there's a million things to write about. And, you know, I kind of just said to her, listen, if Randy wants to do the article, we'll do it. And if she doesn't, then forget it. We're not doing the article. So I then called him and just asked him, you know, what would you think about this? And immediately he's like, yes, write it. Like, that's so cool. So, you know. He was all for doing it. So as soon as he was excited about it, I got excited about it, and I just told my mom, like, we're doing the article if you like it or not. So eventually she came on board. But, you know, it was kind of stressful for them because, like anything I write, I don't let any of the subjects read it, and I wouldn't let my family read it either. Right. So they were a little stressed out because they're like, what are you going to write? You know, because my family's had kind of a difficult past with divorce and my brother, and they're just like, how much are you including and how much are you including about Randy? So, you know, it was a fine line between what I should put in there and just what's too personal. And, you know, even talking to my brother, just even about his sex life, is a little awkward.
Right, right.
You know,
did he have any hesitation about, you know, some of the more personal aspects of this story being included? Was he at all reluctant to have some of that out there?
The only thing he was reluctant about was what's happening now. He just didn't want me to include, you know, like I was going to go further with his first date after he met the girl on the bus at the end. And he's like, you're not including that. I had to stop it. But no, he was pretty open with me. We interviewed over a few months' time. Some of it was in person. Some of it was over the phone. The parts that were, like, very hard to talk about, you know, just him going to, him breaking down and, you know, going to a mental hospital, like, that was in person. So it was just different parts were talked about. And, I mean, I lived some of it, too, so... It wasn't that hard for me to write because I witnessed a lot of it.
And I was going to ask you about how you kind of put together these different pieces, but you kind of touched on that. Were there things that you learned as you were researching and reporting this a little bit that you didn't know about, things that maybe you weren't as aware of at the time that some of the stuff was happening?
I was pretty aware of most of it. Our family has, you know, although my parents are divorced, you know, we have a pretty open communication when it involves Randy. So, you know, we all kind of talk about everything. So I don't know if I learned so much about him because I pretty much knew most of it, but finding the timeline was interesting just because, you know, well, I guess there were little things just growing up of how he was. Like, I remember it from my perspective, but it's interesting talking to my parents about it because obviously they have a much more integrated personal perspective than I do just like witnessing as a young kid. So I think just talking to them about how he was when he was little and, you know, how he was born, like I thought he was born with brain damage and I later found out that wasn't true. Right. So I guess, you know, just going through like piece by piece with my mom, how he was delivered and what actually happened to him. And, yeah, then just piecing together. I think I didn't know as much the dates of everything as what had happened. So, you know, just going through with both of them and kind of, and I interviewed my mom and my dad separately. So, you know, just getting both their stories and then finding, you know, the middle of that and my brother's story. It was just interesting seeing everyone's perspective, including my own. So,
yeah, it seems like that's always a bit of an issue when someone's writing something that is at least in part memoir and that there's your memory and your recollection of things, but you almost have to validate some of that with other people that can say, well, that's not exactly how I remember that happening.
Right. It's true. I think the hardest part for both my parents was going through in the story Sarah, the girl that's like consistently through the whole piece, and just, you know, it was troublesome because I distinctly remember when my brother was going through it, and granted, we didn't know he was even dating anyone. Right. So when she flew to Florida, like none of us knew. So, you know, eventually when he went missing for a week, you know, we knew pretty quickly because my mom was calling every day crying, like, where is he? You know, we were all scared.
Right.
So I think that was the hardest for our family to go through, just because we didn't know her intentions. And she would, it's hard. It's hard with someone who has a disability because ultimately, like, my brother really does want to find someone. And, you know, he's such a loving boy, and it's hard. It just is. And I think he's just looking for acceptance and someone to love him. And to be honest, you know, anyone who shows him the slightest bit of attention online, he falls in love with, you know. It's just that's like what he sees as love. He doesn't entirely understand it. So, you know, if some girl's telling him or some woman's telling him, like, hey, I'm flying across the country to see you, like, you know, that becomes, oh, we're in love.
Right.
Like, so, yeah, it was scary, and we all had to live through it, and we weren't sure about her. And, you know, when she went to visit my dad, it just was a nightmare.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much.
It seemed like that was an interesting tension in the story. And I imagine other families with similar situations often deal with this, in that in some ways, you know, your brother is an adult. You know, he's in the eyes of the world, he's a grown man, right? But obviously with some of his special needs, your family feels an obligation to try and also protect him from someone who could be taking advantage of that. And yet you also realize that
right.
He's an adult that has things that he really desires and wants to fulfill in his life. And it seemed like that was a really difficult balancing act for your family in this story, and obviously for him.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I think, I don't, you know, it was interesting because when I was interviewing him, he had such an interesting approach to how he saw all these relationships. I mean, much different than interviewing my parents. It's just that it was very matter of fact, like, this happened. I don't even know if he entirely grasped all of what has happened to him. I don't think he understands, like, her going through my parents' filing cabinet to see their income and tax, you know, write-offs and whatever else she was going through. I don't think he understood what that meant. Like, why? You know, it was just like, well, she did do that. You know, but the implication was, why did she do it? Like,
right.
He doesn't entirely grasp it. Or, like, you know, the cops being called, like, he thought it was, like, funny. Like, you know, he just
right.
And he doesn't really get everything. And so, in some ways, there's this, like, naive aspect to my brother that is charming.
Right.
Right. You know, if you don't laugh, you cry. So that's kind of like our family motto.
So let's talk a little bit about, as you started to write this piece, how, you know, it sounds like you know, you talked to your family, you talked to your brother, you had your own recollections and experiences. How did you sort out what to actually include in this story? You know, how did you figure out what was, you know, what were the key scenes and key elements that would be part of this piece?
Yeah, that was probably the most difficult part because I had so much. And I also talked to a lot of experts too, which wasn't included in any of my piece. And that was decided later on in the editing process that we just were going to stick to my family story. But, you know, at first I had interviewed a few experts, a psychiatrist that deals with special needs kids. I had talked to the brother of the guy who wrote Running with Scissors, who also has autism and wrote a book. So there were just, you know, a bunch of people I had talked to just about exactly this, you know, just a kid who has autism, young, trying to find love, and then, you know, as a teenager and a young adult. So I just wanted to understand from, you know, that perspective. But then you know, once we got more into the editing process, we decided not to use anyone else, which, you know, was fine. I think, you know, there were difficult parts to the story because whenever you're going to write a personal story about your family, you have to be careful. And that was something that I, you know, was important to me to not go too far because, you know, if I wrote about everything, it may have been a different story. So, you know, this is the fine line of balancing what is appropriate and not appropriate. So, with first, I think it was just kind of a natural progression with my editor to kind of decide what needs to be in there. But we outlined it in, like, I think 6 parts at first. And then we kind of took it from there and kept adding it. And, you know, I would say, I think this is just too confusing. Like, if I'm confused reading this, then no one else is going to understand it. So we just, my editor and I, bounced off ideas with each other. And I think eventually we got down to what we liked. I thought it was important to kind of use more than one story to illustrate this point, just because at first I was just going to use Farah's entire story. And then I was like, but he's had so many others, you know? And I just thought you could kind of illustrate all the points was important. So, you know, I picked 3. And I don't know, I think it kind of made the point I wanted to, which, you know, it was hard. And it's not an easy read. It's not like a fun read either. You know, it's hard. It was hard for all of us. It was hard for him. But I thought it was also really important. And, yeah, the story structure kind of just went the way that naturally I think we all, you know, my editors decided and I decided it was meant to read like that. So we played around a lot, but I was very adamant about starting the piece when I was 10 because I thought, and I didn't want it to make it about me, but I wanted people to understand there's not a lot of people do that. Like, it's not just like, oh, your kid has autism. Like, that's cute. It's like, no, the struggle of that is so intense and it's hard. And my brother has had it pretty bad. So, you know, I just wanted to illustrate that point that it's never easy and nothing is. But, yeah, I just wanted you to, like, feel what we felt in that moment many times in my life and my parents' life. So,
I thought that yeah. It's funny. You led right into one of my next questions, which was that opening scene. I thought that was, you know, very, very powerful. And, you know, it's basically in your brother's bedroom, and there's a sort of a big emotional moment there. And I think it's really kind of interesting because it's one of the only real moments you're in the story. Like, you're in it in little bits and pieces later on as you kind of talk about sometimes secondhand sort of interactions you had with your brother. But that's the only one where you seem to be in the scene, at least visibly. So was that always, you know, you said that was kind of always where you kind of wanted to start. Why was that important to you to make that like your kind of opening scene?
I don't know. I just felt like it should be. Ever since my first draft, I had it as the front. I think my editor changed it once and put it somewhere else, and I, like, moved it right back. Because I just thought it was really strong there. And at first, I didn't have myself in the piece at all besides that opening. And I really don't that much throughout the piece. But, you know, my editor kind of said to me, like, I think you need to be more in this piece. Like, so, which I didn't know if I agreed with because I didn't want it to be about me and how I felt. It was about my brother. So, you know, I kind of tried to balance it of just inserting myself at points where I thought it was important. But I thought the beginning was, you know, it brings you right in, which I guess in any article you want to intrigue the reader into reading beyond the first sentence. So, you know, I just thought it drew you in. It kind of got you in a headspace to understand the rest of the story.
Well, I think it really worked well. And I think in a weird way, it was kind of like the perfect prologue because it's 2 paragraphs and it's just, this is the one part of the story that feels like your story. And then it shifts almost entirely for the rest of the piece to looking at everything that's going on with him. So I felt like it was a perfect way of kind of showing, like, this is why you're writing about this. This is kind of big picture what this is about, and his need to sort of want things that everybody else can kind of take for granted. You know, so I thought, I'm glad you put it back in front. I think that worked. tell me a little bit about that writing process. Like, you mentioned there was an outline. Do you tend to just write from an outline? Do you kind of write in little scenes and then stitch them together?
I don't think there's a rhyme or reason to how I write, and I think it depends on the subject. I often just, usually I'll just, interview someone and then transcribe everything out. And then I kind of just look at the transcription and formulate what I'm going to write. I often, to be honest, don't outline anything. I just start writing. And I think that's, like, the beauty of it is, it takes you wherever it's going to take you. The writing process for me is the most exciting part after the interview. You get to just, kind of put everything, your emotions, the person's emotions on a page, and then, the editing part is the most meticulous. So, I think for this piece, I do believe I sectioned it off as it is now, but I wasn't entirely sure, what was going to go in, what was not going to go in, and there were other parts to this story that were also, and I mean, I can talk about it, just, we decided not to put it in, which was this other dimension of how hard it is for kids with autism, specifically my brother, talking to, like, online people, because that was a huge concern for my family. Is just my brother, he's 28, but he connects with young girls who are often much younger. There were bits and pieces of, just looking at porn, and, like, there were parts that are just like, is this necessary? Like, what does this do to the story? And if it doesn't tell anything, we just take it out. But yeah, it was just interesting picking, what was important and what wasn't important. And I was going to go more into the mental institution and what that did to him. And then it was kind of like, if I make everything a big deal, then it just becomes a very dramatic piece. You know what I mean? I had to choose what was important and not.
So. It almost sounded like you could have written three different articles about this, right? I mean, you could have had one. I mean, say you could have had a really researched thing about what it's like for people with autism and relationships. You could have had a piece about, what it does for someone to be in some of these institutions and what it does for their freedom and their ability to do the kind of things that most adults take for granted. And then there was the story that it seems to me you did write, which was a much more personal story about, just his experience and, some of his challenges. And it touches on those issues. But it obviously didn't go too far into those.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And, it's funny you say that, because my editor was like, you can write like five stories in this, because my brother's also had a very interesting life. Like, aside from the whole love and relationships, like, I had included so much about his past. And he's, ever since he was young, was at a boarding school for special needs kids, and then went to these, like, psychiatrists who... It's just this whole long other crazy story too. So it's like, and a lot of it had to deal with being taken advantage of, and it's just sad stuff, and it's interesting to read. But I wanted to focus on one thing, and it's kind of why I decided, actually, I'm writing a proposal to do a memoir about his life, because it's just so fascinating. But I just thought it would be important to stick with the idea of love and what love meant to him. Otherwise, you'd be reading a piece that just goes everywhere. That, it would just seem like a mess. So I just wanted to stick to the basics and what we all thought was important. So.
And the ending, you mentioned it a little bit, that you kind of had originally wanted to go a little further, but he didn't want you to get too much into his current dating status. But did you struggle at all with how to tie up this piece at the end?
No, because I knew that I had to do it from now. And, you know, I really just, at the time that I wrote the piece, I really just called him and was like, what's your dating life like? What are you doing? And, you know, and my mom had told me he met someone on a bus. So I was like, oh, this is a perfect ending. So, and she's like, Danielle, do not use him. And I was like, I'll ask him. So I called my brother and I was just like, hey, mom told me, you know, you met a girl on a bus. And he was like, so pissed. he was like, you know, I was like, fine, you can use it. He's like, but no more. I don't want to talk about anything else. I think he was also just sick of me talking about right. But, you know, this has been months of me hassling him every day, like, what did you think of this? Do you remember this? You know, so I think he was just like, I had enough.
Why did I say yes to this?
Exactly. But, yeah, he, you know, I called him and just asked him what was going on. And he told me, you know, he did meet this girl on a bus. So that was kind of what I decided. I also wanted a happy ending. I mean, and if it weren't happy, that's fine too, but I loved that it was. I was actually so thankful that in that moment of me writing the ending, it actually had a somewhat happy one because, and not that you can, that's just, I got lucky because it could have been sad and I just didn't want to end on this note of just, and there's no hope, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't even know if I would characterize it as happy, as more just kind of hopeful and optimistic, right? That it didn't end with this woman going back overseas because it didn't work out and she seemed a little bit suspicious. You know, it does seem like I guess what I'm saying is it felt real. Like it felt like a lot of people's social lives, like how would it characterize my social life when I was dating, which was there's a mix of optimism and hope,
right.
Even if the last thing didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, it's not like I could, and if there wasn't that piece, you know, it may have been a different ending, but it just so happened that's what was going on in his life. So I just decided to include it as an ending. And I think you're right. And I mean, let's be honest, like we all want some hopeful ending to every story. So I think, and I wanted that for other people because, you know, there is something about, and I've had so many parents reach out to me and say, you know, I've always wondered about this. When my kid gets older, what's it going to be like for him or her? And I wanted people to know, and it wasn't some orchestrated thing, but I mean, maybe subconsciously, that there is hope. You know, there are a lot of people who have disabilities who find love. And if that's with someone else who has a disability or someone who doesn't, there's hope for everyone. It's not just quote unquote normal people. I wanted to illustrate that.
I think that was one of the things that struck me about the stories. And in many ways, it was very interesting and insightful about people with a very different situation. But on the other hand, you know, I was reading this and I was thinking, that's not so different than a lot of people's dating histories. I mean, you know, in the sense that people often make bad decisions about who they decide to date, right? People often struggle with a relationship where someone is too clingy, right? Which kind of happens to your brother
right.
in this piece. And in some ways I felt, boy, he's
yeah.
dealing with things that a lot of us don't have to deal with. And then at the same time, it was also, you know, he's dealing with dating things just like most single people do. And he's still back out at it again. And in a way that I felt like there was something kind of almost nice about the fact that he's just back out there again trying, which is, you know, instead of being sort of locked up
yeah.
in his room because he's given up.
Right, which I think is my brother in a nutshell. And I don't know if that's the behavior of all autistic people. And I don't think it is. But yeah, I don't think there are a lot of issues with my brother. And one of them being it's very hard for him to hold down a job because he has severe ADD and he has, you know, attention problems. And it's just, I think it's a huge struggle and frustration for him. So at times, I think he does give up a lot and just say, like, I just can't do this. But one thing in his life that's remained consistent is, you know, he hasn't really given up on finding someone. And I think he really, really wants it. So, yeah, I think for him, it's just about going out there and putting yourself out there. And I think sometimes that's hard for him. And it's a lot easier, like, on the internet especially these days, which is also scary, is you really can talk to anyone. And I think sometimes for him, it's easier to maybe be someone else at first, which I think is something he has to work on, is just be okay with who you are. And you don't have to be anyone else. I think for him, he is looking for someone. I think it's hard to meet people in person for him, and he tries. And I think he's also pretty outgoing. Mm-hmm. For the most part, he can be very shy too, but you start talking about something he likes, like hockey, like he can go on forever about it, you know. Right. So unfortunately, the story doesn't end well now, because, you know, that girl on the bus ended up, a problem that Randy has is just knowing boundaries, and I don't think he fully understands them. And, you know, for someone who does understand those things, you can text a woman or a man, and, you know not to send 40 text messages. You know, just a little excessive. Right. But for him, he doesn't get if someone's not answering their phone, like, immediately. He's like, well, they're ignoring me, so I'm going to just keep texting them until they finally respond. And, you know, that would kind of freak anyone out who doesn't know someone. So that's kind of what he did with this girl. It's just like, where are you? What are you doing? When can we go on? And just too many messages. It scares someone away. But yeah, unfortunately, he never actually went out on a date with that girl. And also, unfortunately, he lost his job at Disney. So, you know, right now he's just kind of in a state of, you know, what do I do next?
Well, hopefully that'll make a turn for the better soon.
I know, right?
I was kind of interested in the, you know, someone who I deal with design and kind of visual storytelling in my day job. There's a lot of photos in this piece, and there's a lot of family photos. There's some shots that someone took for the story. Yeah. I was curious about that. Was that your call, or was that the suggestion of Esquire? Like, how did all those photos become part of the story?
It was Esquire. They wanted a bunch of photos in the story. And, you know, I called my mom because I didn't have any. Like, I had stuff on my phone, but they're like, that's not going to work. So I called my mom, and, you know, she's saved photos ever since we were babies. So I was just like, I need a bunch of family photos. She's like, are you serious? Oh, no. So, you know, she went through all her boxes and dug up all these photos. And I actually had to, you know, get them all scanned and send them into Esquire. And they kind of, you know, their design team put it together. But then my mom didn't have any, like, really great recent pictures of him. So they decided to do a photo shoot with my brother. So that's how that went down. That's how they got the rest of the photos, which I think is kind of cool. And although he did look a little sad in them, I don't know. I wasn't at the photo shoot, but
right.
So, you know, I think he kind of went with the story pretty well.
It seemed like the family photos almost, I mean, the photo shoot shots were nice, but I think you're right. They felt like they were very deliberately kind of moody. But the family shots, I think, definitely gave you a better sense of intimate sense of the story, because it kind of gave you these visual images to go along with your story about what it was like being around him growing up and seeing him bullied and seeing him fight with struggle with things. And, it, you know, I think made it really a nice touch to go along with the piece.
Well, I was very lucky that, you know, although my mom was hesitant at first, that they were all willing to go on the record with the real names. Like, a lot of times in a lot of stories I read, like, everyone's names change. And although I did have to change the names of the girls, you know, I was, like, very grateful that my parents were willing to use their real names, and my brother was willing to use his real name, and that they were willing to, like, put their picture in there, just because it is a hard story to read. And I don't know. I mean, there's something about putting a face with a name, which you don't see always in these kind of pieces, where you can actually see the person you're talking about. So I was just lucky that my brother was willing to do the photo shoot, and they were willing to put the pictures in there. I don't know. There, I guess it gives another layer to the story that you feel a little more connected to all of us, just in, even in a glimpse of a story. You're like, oh, these are those people. That's interesting.
So You said that you don't share your story with your subjects, and in this case, you didn't share it with your family. So when the story was published in February, first tell me what was your brother's reaction to the piece?
It was interesting. I was so nervous because I didn't know what they would think. And my mom would call me and be like, what's the story? Like, how is it? And I'm like, it's good. It's fine. My brother, I called him first, but he was at work. So I didn't get to talk to him until later. But my mom called me crying. And she was just like, it was so beautiful. I mean, she was just so touched. She was like in a parking lot hysterical. It was just like, you know, you did such a good job, and I loved it, which was nice to hear because I was the most nervous for her. You know, my dad really liked the piece a lot as well, and my brother, when I finally got to talk to him, I was like, did you read it? And he's like, yeah, I read it, which I still don't know if he fully understood what he read, but it was the most exciting for him because he thought he was, like, famous.
Right.
So, you know, as far as like tweeting to him, and he's like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And, you know, all these people reached out to him. So I think he felt really special. And I think it meant a lot to him that he could share the story. And he's still tweeting about
right.
it. It came out in February, you know, and he's just like, you know, tweeting to Oprah, being like, can I come on your show? Really,
I actually, that struck me. I couldn't find today where that was, but I saw after the story came out, there were comments. I don't know if it was on Esquire or on Facebook somewhere, but there were a lot of comments of people reacting to the story, and he was very active responding to them. Like, people were sort of saying, like,
yes.
They're saying, like, oh, you know, this was such a moving story. I'm really rooting for Randy. I hope he finds someone that deserves him. And he's like, thanks, I'm trying. And he's like responding to things. And I thought that was fantastic. I loved how that he was so not only aware in the story and, you know, happy to be part of it, but he was really engaged with the people responding to it, you know, in a very personal way.
So much so. Yeah, he definitely, there were a lot of comments on the Esquire piece online. And yeah, I think for a while he was just reading all of them and responding. And same with Twitter. I think it was just exciting for him that people cared, you know, that they wanted to hear a story and they were supporting him. And you never know, which is always the scary part about writing anything personal, because, you know, at times people write stories and they don't always get a good response. Like, I mean, my theory is like, just never read the comments. Whatever you do, just never read them. But I was also very happy that everyone was very supportive, because it could have went the other way of people telling me, you know, how dare you write this? Like, you're exploiting your brother. You know, there's so many ideas and feelings people have. So I was very grateful and lucky that it was pretty much supportive of writing it. And I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, beyond his reaction, when you actually were getting more of like a broader public reaction to the piece, what was that like? And what were some of the reactions or responses or messages you got from people?
Yeah, I got a lot of, so many responses. A lot of people on Facebook wrote me, you know, people I didn't know, who were just like, I read this piece and it touched me, and thank you. And I had never really read a piece like this that went into, like, detail as far as, there have been other love and autism stories, but this one, I don't know. I just had never read something quite like this before. And so I think that was kind of the reaction I got from a lot of people. It's just like, wow, this really opened my eyes to what I need to know for my kid. It was a lot of adults who had kids who had autism and have thought about this and contemplated this and were nervous and scared for this. So I think it just helped them to kind of see, all right, well, these are some difficulties we're going to have to maybe experience. So it's good to know this now. But yeah, I think the reactions have been interesting. I mean, one thing that was special for me is my aunt reached out to me, who I hadn't talked to in probably 10 years, who called me and was just like, I can't believe that you all went through this. Like, you know, and I'm sorry I didn't get to share any of that, you know, to be there for you guys. So that was nice that, you know, even family read this story. So, and I, a lot of people reached out to my parents. My dad said even where he's from in Allentown, Pennsylvania, you know, people came up to him and was just like, that story touched me in such a way. Like, I had no idea, you know, because it's not like you shout from the rooftops, like, hey, I have an autistic child and it's really hard. You know, people don't know your private lives, and it's not like my parents talk about it with every person. So I think for them too, it was just eye-opening to have so many people contact them and say, wow, like, that's incredible. Your daughter did the story, and I'm glad she did it because it meant a lot to me. You know, people who knew my brother even helped him when we were young.
Well, I think it was a beautiful piece, and I think you are right that I think it's the kind of story that I haven't read before, and I think that's probably true of a lot of readers. So thanks for writing in such a great piece and sharing it with everyone. I hope more people will check it out and learn a little bit from reading this piece.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much again to Daniel Bacher for coming on the show. A few final thoughts I had about this week's episode. First of all, I think what struck me about this article when I read it the first time and then reading it again before I talked to Daniel is just how much this is very different than anything I've read before. One thing I found reading a lot of long-form nonfiction is that there's a lot of genres within nonfiction writing. There's crime things. There's stories about politics. There's profiles of people. This story was just very different. You know, it was very personal. It was very intimate. It answered questions that some of us have wondered about, which is, you know, what is it like for someone with autism to try to have relationships or to try and find relationships out there? And I think she revealed things in this story that I don't think I've seen covered very well or very thoroughly anywhere else. The other thing I really found interesting about this story, and it reminded me a little bit of the last episode where I talked with Taylor Harris, was that this story is very intimate and very personal. It deals with her family and someone she obviously loves and cares about. And so I think it takes a lot of courage to put that story out there, especially because the story doesn't really have an ending. We don't know what's going to happen with Randy. We don't know where he's going to be 2 years from now or 5 years from now. And I think what makes this story kind of poignant is that we don't know if he's going to find the love that he's looking for. The story might have a fantastic ending 5 years from now, and hopefully Danielle will share that with us. But it might be a challenge for Randy for some time. And I think that's what makes this story really compelling. We don't know what's going to happen to Randy. And so we're given this very personal and intimate insight into some of the challenges that he and his family are facing as he gets older and is trying to reach out to the world and find someone for him. And we don't know if the story is going to have a happy ending. And I just really love how the story lays that out there. The story mixes some sadness, some humor. It paints a very realistic picture of what Randy's up against. And it leaves the reader with a little bit of hope, a little bit of optimism for the future, but no guarantees. And in the end, that makes it real. That's it for this week on the Nonfiction Podcast. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, I'm Matt Pusateri.